He's like, okay, well, just say that he's 60.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
Georg Dreimann.
Das ist ziemlich unser einziger Autor, der nichts Verdächtiges schreibt.
Ich würde ihn überwachen lassen.
Der OTS steht ab morgen früh auf dein Zeichen für die Verwanzung bereit.
All right. Hello, everybody. This is Recotopia.
Hello.
Recotopia episode 26. The big recommend today is The Lives of Others. How's everybody doing out there who's watching us in the chat today?
Looks I'm lively.
Good. Glad to see you guys coming out once again, coming out strong. I've heard quite a few of you over the week through the various things, the Discord and things like that, who really enjoyed The Lives of Others. So I can't wait to get into it. I don't even know if Jeremy likes this movie yet.
We'll find out.
Hello chat. Glad to see you here. How you doing, Jeremy?
I'm doing well. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing all right, man. Doing
hey,
right.
Buddy.
Yeah. Hey, buddy. Do you have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Yeah, let's kick it off. Mm-hmm. If you follow me on any of the socials, you already know that I'm going to recommend the movie Prey on Hulu, which is a prequel to the Predator movies.
Yes.
And I have now seen this three times,
mm-hmm.
so it's fair to call me a homer, but I love this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There are one or two nits that I would pick and probably a handful of sins I could write if I wanted to.
Sure.
This movie basically goes back to the year 1719 in the upper Great Plains of North America, and we're following mostly Comanche people.
Mm-hmm.
Naru is the main character, and she wants to be a warrior, while her society wants her to be a medicine person. She's good at both. And simultaneously, we're cutting away to a spaceship that drops off a Predator. And one of my favorite things about this movie is the Predator's technology being 300 years older than what we saw in the Arnold movie.
Mm-hmm.
In the Arnold movie, he's got those three lasers and beams, and they shoot like some kind of a energy laser kind of a beam.
Mm-hmm.
And in this movie, they shoot metal rods.
Mm-hmm.
And the armor is kind of different. He only has thermal vision. He doesn't have like infrared and other kinds of like vision to switch to.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really nice touch to show, you know, how much that species had evolved, you know, while we're showing, you know, where our own species was back in this era. There's a one shot where she takes on about eight guys in a campsite,
mm-hmm.
using fists and knees, but also a hatchet on the end of a rope. And I was watching that scene the first time through, and I paused it and I said, when was the last time they cut? Like, I'm so used to, we mostly pin it on Marvel, but I'm so used to hyper-cut action scenes, which is done to hide the lack of, you know, agility of the performer.
Mm-hmm.
And there are pans in this scene, and so from what I have read, it's a lot like Last Night in Soho, where when the camera goes full over this way, the stunt girl swaps out with the actress, and as it pans back through, mm-hmm. the stunt girl is doing a stunt, and it pans back over to the side. It's still an incredible one-shot. And anyway, yeah, I don't want to spoil anything, really. There is a Comanche dub version on Hulu if you want to watch it in that language.
Hmm.
but it is a dub. Their lips are still moving in English.
Yeah.
That did take me a few minutes to get used to the first time. But this is Dan Trachtenberg,
mm-hmm.
who made 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah.
And a largely unknown cast of authentic Native American people.
Yeah.
The fights, the battles, there's some really clever stuff, I thought. But my very favorite thing about the movie is that the stuff that seems inconsequential in the beginning, almost every single bit of it comes back around to have a more important meaning later on by the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I just really appreciated the care that went into the structure of this film. So there you go. It's on Hulu if you have Hulu. If not, I guess you got to wait or borrow somebody else's Hulu. It's called Prey, and I love it. It's my favorite.
Yeah, and this this Amber Midthunder is a super appealing actor. I can't wait to see her in more stuff. She was in, apparently, she was in Hell or High Water. She's one of the tellers in that movie. I think she's the one.
Oh, wow.
She's the one where, can't think of his name right now. The one he knocks off that it's not part of the branch.
Oh, Ben Foster. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I think she's that one. She's in that one. Maybe she's the teller there, but she's apparently teller not. She's she's from New Mexico. So I'm assuming that was like a local, you know, call out back when she was in that, but that's kind of interesting. She was in that, but,
yeah.
But yeah, Prey is really good. I like how, it's not just the predator. It's a ton of other animals in this that are,
yeah.
are problems. So it's not just her against the predator the whole time. There's a whole bunch of other stuff going on. So,
oh yeah. Oh yeah.
All right. So I rewatched, The Virgin Suicides, recently.
Ooh,
and
wow.
This is Sofia Coppola's, I think it was her first movie. I can't remember if she, don't know if she had made something before this, but the biggest name in the movie is Kirsten Dunst. And well, the biggest young actor's name in that is Kirsten Dunst. There's a lot of like the parents are played by James Woods and Kathleen Turner. And, there's a Danny DeVito shows up, as a psychologist in this, and Josh Hartnett, I think was one of his, it was, I think it was the first movie he did after H2O, which was his first movie. So he was still in the beginnings of his, career at this point, but it is a really mysterious movie. And in a lot of it, yeah. a lot of it, you wonder how much of this actually happened because, it's being told through the perspective of these boys who are across the street.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things that they talk about, they're kind of unreliable narrators all the way through it. So it makes you wonder how much of this stuff actually happened, how much of this was, you know, whatever, but, taking it at face value, it's about these five sisters who live in a really oppressive religious, you don't see it in the house. You don't see overt religious, pressure much, but you do see it. You see one room mm-hmm. where some girl's got a bunch of crosses in her room. There's a point where Kathleen Turner, the mom, tells Kirsten Dunst she's got to burn all of her rock records. There's all sorts of things like that that are happening. And there's a point where they tell the girls they can't go to school anymore. They have to be at the house the whole time. And in the movie starts off, you know, disturbingly enough that, you know, the girl from Forrest Gump who played young Jenny, Hannah Hall, who's playing the youngest of the daughters, attempts suicide. And they think it's just a call. The psychologist thinks it's just a call for help. It's nothing to be that serious about and all that. And, before you know it, she is the first one to die in the movie. And, meanwhile, you see these girls and they just don't seem to care about what other people care about. But it's, again, this is sort of what the guys are seeing from their perspective. They don't understand mm-hmm. girls. And they are quick to say the girls understand us completely. They know what we're all about. We just don't know what they're about. And there's a point where a kid is at a locker and he's trying to say hi to one of the sisters. And she's like, hey, And he's like, well, hey, my name is this. He's like, I know what your name is. You don't have to talk to me if you don't want to. And then walks off. And you think it's kind of standoffish, but like, you know, who knows what that's all about, really, when it comes from these dudes' perspective throughout the whole thing. The movie is darkly comic. It's got a lot of funny moments in it. But you get the sense that there's, even though you're told right off the bat, this isn't going to end well, you get the sense that there's some sort of hope in all of this. I think that's where the crash comes into this movie. There's some sort of hope in this because you're like, you know, even though they don't look morose or anything throughout the whole movie, they just seem to be living in their own world. You can see that there's like a lot of boredom and there's a lot of oppression and there's a lot of things that they're having to deal with. And then when Kirsten Dunst finally gets to date in the movie, you know, there's a point where you see that, oh, she could be just, you know, she could just be coming out of her shell. She's not really in a shell throughout the whole movie, but she looks like she's finally excited about life, basically. And then Josh Hartnett does something to her that ruins everything. It spirals everything out of control. So like, this movie is really good. Sofia Coppola, this is just like her wheelhouse back in the day to tell stories like these. It does have dark subject matter. So if you are, you know, if you have a trigger about that, then you will see a couple of things that are a little, I mean, it doesn't go graphic, I don't think, but it does have that subject matter in it. But this is just a fascinating movie. I don't think people talk about it enough. And, you get to see a lot of young actors, like sort of like coming into their own. Kirsten Dunst had been around forever at this point, but, you know, you see a lot of these, like Jonathan Tucker, who looks super like a baby in this movie and, things like that. But this movie is really, really good. The Virgin Suicides, highly recommend.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's good stuff. Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to, go with my second small recommend. I'm sticking with movies, both of them this year,
mm-hmm.
this week.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go with The Founder. This is Michael Keaton playing Ray Kroc,
mm-hmm.
Known mostly as the founder of McDonald's. What this movie charts is how that came to be. And it does make him sympathetic in many ways. But the actual McDonald's was started by two brothers whose last name is McDonald. And you have Parks and Rec mustache guy, Nick Offerman. And probably the Zodiac guy from Zodiac Live, John Carroll Lynch. So they own McDonald's, and Ray Kroc only stumbles upon them because they order a milkshake mixer that he sells,
mm-hmm.
and it can make 6 milkshakes at one time, and they order like 8 of them, and he's like, I gotta see what this is all about. So he throws the mixers in his car and drives to this place and sees lines out the wazoo, stands in line and gets a hamburger, goes over to the bench and sits down. He's amazed. The kid gives him his hamburger and he goes, oh, that's not mine, I just ordered 30 seconds ago. And he's like, and here it is, here's your food. He goes over and eats it, says it's the best hamburger he's ever tasted in his life, and starts a friendship with these two guys because he tries to learn more and more about how they came up with what they call the speedy system. And this is basically the invention of fast food,
mm-hmm.
where they have created their own pieces of equipment that specifically dole out the right amount of ketchup and mustard for each bun. And they took kids to this tennis court and chalked off a fake kitchen and practiced all the stations and walking them through. This is we have a burger crossing. And when you cross with the burgers, you yell, burger crossing, burger crossing. And it's all very charming and cute. And Ray convinces them, they had tried 3 other locations to franchise and it hadn't worked out. They couldn't get those locations to do the right consistency of quality product. But he convinces them to franchise again to him. And basically becomes almost a parasite. I don't know what you would call an organism that sucks all of the lifeblood and essentially, you know, through growth He opens franchises without their permission, without telling them. He's just go, 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 go. And before you know it, he owns like hundreds of them and they own very few. And then they go to court and he ends up winning. And by the time I'm a child, he's known as the father of McDonald's. And this movie really shines a light for me on how that came to be. And it's a true capitalism story. But Michael Keaton is subtly awesome in this. The first time I saw this movie, I wasn't super impressed with it. Mm-hmm. And that was because I was expecting more of a powerhouse mm-hmm. kind of drama acting.
Yeah.
And it's really a lot more of a charming. Have you seen this
movie? I've never seen it, no.
This is a little more of a charming kind of a story than it is a drama. But yeah, I've seen it 3 or 4 times now. And Keaton is just really, really good and sympathetic in that. He's just driven to be successful at something.
Mm-hmm.
And this is finally something he's successful at, and he loses sight of the fact that it's not really his. He took it from somebody else. Anyway, great little drama with plenty of little comedy, quirky moments in it, and I recommend it. So there you go. The Founder.
Yeah, I've got this. I should watch it at some point. You know, I've heard it's, I've heard the same thing though. I've heard, you know, people saying that it was okay. And then, you know, somebody like you has seen it, what you've seen it multiple times now, right?
Yeah. 3 or 4 probably.
You know, where you've grown to appreciate it. So, I'll get on that. The other movie that I saw, and yes, somebody asked if Virgin Suicides was Criterion. Yes, it was. It was a 4K Criterion that I bought that I watched.
Wow, there you go.
A lot of the reason why I'm like immediately opening and watching these is because I've gotten a bad run of discs that have been skipping. Like the Devil in the Blue Dress one that I was talking about, that one was like skipping and stuff, and I had to get a new one for that. And there was another one, and there was even one I watched, the Raging Bull one, that had like, it looked like it had just tons of scratches on it, and I popped it in, it played just fine. So I have no idea what's going on with that. But anyway, Virgin Suicides was a 4K Criterion. I also watched on the Criterion channel the Thin Man. I had never seen this. Ooh. Of course, there's a lot of whatever man movies, you know, The Third Man, The Wrong Man, The Thin Man, Beyond the Thin Man, or whatever the hell. A really interesting structure of these movies back in the day, 1930s. This is a comedy essentially, but with a murder mystery at its heart. It's about a couple that have been seeing each other for a while, and they come to see the father, who is like some sort of, I don't know, metallurgist. He's some sort of like, he works with metal or something like that. I don't know exactly what it is, but he runs his own shop. They go by to tell him, hey, we're going to get married. And he's like, okay. When he goes up and he goes to his safe to get some bonds out of there it's like $50,000 worth of bonds. And they're missing. There's an accountant there who looks really shady while he's going through his safe, and he's like, do you know where these bonds are? Well, maybe you should ask, blah, blah, blah. And it was a secretary. So he goes to the secretary and blah, blah, blah. There's all these millions of people who this guy interacts with. He tells people that he's going to go on this trip. And then, the girl that he went to go see about the bonds, she ends up dead. And so a lot of people think that it's the father, the guy who this guy did it, and he's just away and nobody can find him. And so there's all these just millions of characters and millions of interested parties who show up in this story at the very first. We're introduced to our main detectives, but they don't really get involved until like an hour into the movie. It's really interesting how this goes. William Powell plays Nick Charles, and his wife is played by Myrna Loy. And everybody involved in this mystery seems to know this detective guy, but they don't, you know, they keep coming to him for advice, but he's like, I'm not a detective anymore or whatever. I don't do this type of stuff anymore. And then suddenly he is thrust into the case, about an hour into it, 'cause somebody comes by his house and tries to kill him or tries to question him or something like that. So he gets into it, and, It's one of these movies where there's just a lot of, like, you know, like really quick dialogue and like a lot of stuff. Like, if you didn't pay attention, you just missed something. Or there's a lot of that 1930s kind of expressions where you're like, are they talking about sex there? I don't know. It sounds like they might be talking about sex, but they just kind of really go by fast. So you have the woman who's going to get married. She's got this crazy brother who's like a pseudo intellectual guy. He's totally like just off his rocker throughout the whole movie. He's talking to these newspaper men and saying, yeah, you should say that my dad was a sexagenarian. And he's like, a sexagenarian? I don't know if that kind of thing will fly in the newspaper or whatever. And he's like, okay, well, just say that he's 60. So there's a lot of like just like lines like that just really just fly really quick past you. Those 1930s like trying to get past the censors type things, you know, is just an interesting thing. But it's a lot of fun. The Thin Man, real fun movie. So
Thin Man. Mm-hmm. All right, I have never seen that. Mm-hmm. But I am intrigued.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and Slab says Nick and Nora are one of my favorite movie couples. Yes, they are Nick and Nora in this movie. They have like this tremendous chemistry together, and Myrna Loy is hilarious. She's playing kind of a drunk in this movie. There's a point where she sits down with somebody and she goes, how many drinks have you had tonight? And he's like, I had 6 martinis. And like the waiter comes by and he goes, bartender. And she's already got a drink, put 5 more down in a row right here. And then the scene cuts or something like that. So it's really good stuff.
That's awesome.
All right. So, we ready for the big recommend.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
The big recommend. All right. 2006 German film that won the best foreign language film at the Oscars, and it won 7 of the equivalent German Oscars back in 2006. The Lives of Others, which is set in the in 80s East Germany, before the wall came down in East Berlin, and our main character, played by Ulrich Mühe, I think that's how you pronounce that name. He is part of the Stasi, the State Security Service in Germany. Early on in the film, you see what he does. He's teaching a class of all these kids who are wannabe Stasi members, of how to interrogate someone. And if you are familiar also with like the, you know, a lot of the stuff that, we did to, so-called terrorists down in Guantanamo Bay and things like that, you'll immediately recognize that the techniques that he's using are absolutely nonsense and are monstrous. He basically is playing a recording of this guy that he's trying to get to admit, some information. And, he's depriving him of sleep the whole time. And every time he asks him questions, the guy has the same story. I went over to this guy's house. We listened to some music. I went home. And then he claims that if someone tells the same story over and over, that they're lying. Finally, he broke this guy to finally say something that obviously isn't true, but he just wanted to finally go to sleep for once. There's even a point where one of the students says, isn't that monstrous to deprive him of sleep? And the guy goes over and puts a little X by that guy's desk. That's how insane this is. And so he's like, no, if these people are enemies of the state, they have to be questioned this way. Early on. So his task in this movie is he's been sent by a real higher up to look after this playwright slash author guy who is pretty much on the level, doesn't have anything really that stands out, but this higher up really wants him investigated for some reason. And we find out later it's because of a woman. He really wants him investigated. So they bug this dude's house and it's this guy's job to just sit there and listen to everything that is said all the way through it. And that's even the private moments and the make notes of it. And he's got a shift with some younger guy who comes in late at night and he has his own thing. Not much that guy's going to actually hear because he's just going to hear them sleeping for the most part and just whatever happens in the morning. This guy starts listening to this couple. It's him. It's this writer who's Georg Drayman, and an actress is playing a Krista Maria Zealand, I think. Yeah, Zealand. They are together. They're a romantic couple who are just, they're basically boring except for a few things. And this guy, Gerd, I think is his name, he starts really starting to like this guy. He starts enjoying the things about his life. There's a point where he's playing this beautiful piece of music and says something to the effect that, Lennon says, I can't get on with the revolution if I keep on listening to this, was it Beethoven or Mozart? I can't remember which one it is.
I think it was Beethoven.
And he's like, Georg sits there and he goes, can you consider anybody a bad man who listens to this music? Meanwhile, we're seeing Gerd, who we think is kind of a bad guy because he's one of the state security. He's got a tear streaming down his face because of this music. Mm. There's so many like double layer things in this movie where, you know, there's a point where Gerd runs into Krista Maria and says, I'm your audience. And she thinks he means actor, but he's really talking about a person who's been watching her or listening to her this whole time in the movie. There's all these little extra layers to things about what people say about people they don't know, in this, eventually, though, something does happen where one of the playwrights that Georg knows has been blacklisted. He wrote something 10 years ago that basically made it where he couldn't work again. One of the biggest themes of the movie is when someone can't do the thing that makes them happy anymore. And that's something that what relish the state security puts in doing that too, where they can't do the thing that they like anymore. This guy has been not writing for 10 years. You can see that he's depressed, and Georg even gives him a glimmer of hope, which is the wrong thing to do, that he might be able to write again. Eventually this man ends his life, and the point of the next second part of this movie is that Georg wants to write an article about the suicide rate in East Germany, which is being swept under the rug. So he concocts this idea. He has to kind of do a lot of things in secret. And he finds somebody who's willing to publish it in the Spiegel magazine. And so there's a lot of stuff they have to do in secret. And it's funny, at this moment, the person who's been listening to him the whole time, who should be glad that he's finally found something on this guy, is like, has already like grown to really like this guy enough that he is now helping him in small ways. At first he's like, okay, I'm going to let you have this. I'm going to have you let you have that. But it's like, if it goes a little bit too far, I'll finally have to bust you for this. But he does little things at the very beginning that help him out and at the same time sort of creates another reality, basically. It's sort of an alternate reality where if he just stays off of it, then certain things don't get revealed to Georg at all. Like, for instance, his girlfriend is on every Thursday sleeping with this guy who has directed Georg's apartment to be bugged. Every Thursday he's doing this. And he would never know about it if it's not for the fact that Gerd at one point touches two little wires together and causes the doorbell to ring. And Georg goes down to see what that's all about and sees her getting out of that guy's car. It sets all these different events in motion that would have never happened. And he's basically sealing the fate of certain characters in this without knowing it. It's kind of a Heisenberg principle thing. I might be using that wrong in some way here because it's an observer who's kind of messing with what you would determine as real or whatever. You've messed up. You've messed this up. You've changed it. So there are a lot of layers to this whole thing. There is a discussion that Georg might be bugged, but they go through this whole thing like, well, let's do an experiment to see if you are. And because they discuss this, like smuggling somebody through underneath a seat in a car, and everything, the Gerd thinks that this is it. I've got to have to tell the security officers to look at this guy's car. And then he just decides not to at the last minute. And so then they think that the room isn't being bugged. And then they start talking openly about what they're really writing. They talk about they're going to write a play about the 50th anniversary of the German Democratic Republic, but they're really writing this suicide article the whole time. I don't know how much farther I want to go here, but obviously I think this movie is just tremendous in all respects. And every time it could have ended at a certain point and you would have been fine, but it has just that one little extra dash of greatness at the very end of this movie, that just really, it's one of those cry moments for me in movies. I don't know. We spoil these things. I think people know we're talking about the movie. So, I will let you talk now. Tell me what you think about this movie. We'll go into some other scenes.
I loved it. I think it's going to require a few more viewings, for me to really soak in all the layers and parallels. But what is fascinating is how well it works just on the surface, even if you're not looking for that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fascinating that he ultimately pushes the domino over while trying to be nice, and ultimately it still was the right thing to do. That ending to me tells me it was the right thing to do for him to protect that guy because he ends up writing all his reports to say, oh, they talked more about their Lenin play. They mm-hmm. talked more about their Lenin play. And he never reports the crimes he's overhearing to the higher ups, even while his friend slash immediate boss is openly suggesting he's hiding things.
Mm-hmm.
He even says, I love that scene when they're in the office and he goes, something feels off right now.
Mm-hmm.
You're keeping something back from me. And it's just, it's scary how good these guys must have been at their jobs
mm-hmm.
to be able to pick up on that kind of a thing.
Oh, yeah.
But then he lets it go. He's like, all right, well, go ahead. Go on. I know you're not telling me the whole thing now.
Well, this is a guy who's had an impeccable record to this point, and I think that's what ends up selling him on it, even though in his training and his mind, he realizes something's off the entire time.
Yeah. Well, because he's asking, I want to scale down the investigation and get rid of this other guy helping me.
Because mm-hmm.
the other guy overhears part of the discussion of the suicide article.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, you know, the main character shuts him down and says, that's what you hear here doesn't leave this room. I don't want to hear you talking about it again.
Mm-hmm.
But he's in the office saying, I want it to just be me. I want to be the only one. That's suspicious.
Yeah.
And the other guy picks up on it. There's so many. The movie does a really good job of making you uneasy. Like the lunchroom scene where the young kid comes in telling a joke about one of the Stasi head honchos and then sees the two Stasi guys there and stops. And so the guy's like, no, tell your joke. Let's go. Mm-hmm. I probably heard it before anyway. So the kid tells the joke and the guy goes, name, yeah, rank, department.
Yeah.
And you're like, you've gone from a high back to a low. And then after a couple of seconds, he just breaks out laughing and you're laughing again. And it just, the movie keeps you on your toes in a good way, because mm-hmm. not necessarily everything you see is as it appears.
The great touches of that scene too is, you know, towards the end where they're telling Gerd that he's going to be steam opening envelopes for the rest of his life or whatever. They show him doing that, and behind him is that guy who told the joke.
Well, and that guy who told the joke says in the lunchroom, I'm with the Department M. And then we find out later Department M is the steam opening mm-hmm. envelopes.
Yeah.
He has not made any progress in his career.
No.
He's been doing that for years.
No.
Yeah, I called the main character Stannis the whole time because he looked like the guy who plays Stannis.
Oh, he does. He does.
And for a few minutes, I wondered if it was the same guy actually, but, I thought he gave the best performance because his performance has to be the most reserved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get that single tear, we get that very last scene in the movie, but otherwise he on the surface is very robotic, and the emotions he's experiencing that we feel vicariously for him are all being done with like his eyes
mm-hmm.
and with really subtle twitches of his mouth mm-hmm. or his eyebrows.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the guy playing the writer, who's also great, all the actors are great in this, but he's free to emote however he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait to watch it again and break it down some more and mm-hmm. be like, I'm going to learn something new every time and see some new parallel. But yeah, the ending was a gut punch in a good way for me. Yeah, I don't want to say anything about it except that I loved it.
Yeah.
The ending. That last scene was awesome.
Yeah. I think there's just so many different things that are going on from the fact that, you know, people who don't know they're being observed say things about the character that is observing them without realizing it. There's other dynamics going on there where, you know, like, I think it's fun that all these different choices that are made all the way through, affects the story right in front of him all the way through. And he's just doing minor things, but it changes a lot. The whole thing with him, with Georg looking at his file at the end, that's based in a real thing. You know, that's what they, after the wall came down, they allowed people who had been surveilled to look at their files and all that. And it's an interesting thing for him, watching him read those things and realizing slowly that he had been protected this whole time. Ulrich Mühe actually lived in East Germany during this time, and he was life it was under surveillance. He was an actor. Back in the day, he had people who informed on him. He didn't get into any real trouble, he says, especially compared to what a lot of other people had to go through in this, especially compared to the first guy we see in this, who has to put his hands underneath his legs and has no sleep and all that. But the actor himself has been through this type of thing. And that's a crazy thing to think about. I mean, we're talking about a movie that's only 15 years after, the Berlin Wall came down. So this is not a lot of time here that is passed. They've made a couple of other movies about this, but they were comedies, like Goodbye Lenin was one, and there's another one called was it Sun Valley or something like that. But this was the first time anybody took this kind of thing seriously. But just a fascinating look into surveillance and how it changes people, and some really evil stuff, and you find your humanity in that evil somehow. Like somebody, the hardest guy to crack has turned a new leaf by the end of it. Really fascinating stuff here at the end. So
I think one of the creepiest things in the movie is when he goes over after the interrogation and takes this little piece of cloth off the chair.
Mm-hmm.
And then he explains, while he's putting it in an airtight jar, this is for the dogs later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like
basically, now we have this guy's sweat smell from that interrogation, and we're not going to let that go to waste. We're going to keep it in a jar in case he ever gets loose, and we'll send the dogs after mm-hmm. him. And I was just like, holy fucking shit.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many levels of evil and scary to this whole thing.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's mentioned in the movie, but the Stasi is, I mean, they're... Based on the happenings of World War II, the Soviet Union controls East Berlin, or at least they made that a sort of a communist socialist half of East Berlin. West Berlin was the Allied side and everything, but the East side was this communist socialist side, and the Stasi was working with the KGB and. They had their own offices in the Soviet Union and everything. And it was just like, you know, that just goes all the way back. It goes on, it gets connected all the way back to there. So, yeah. It's just, I don't know what you ultimately gain just a whole bunch of power over your people that you just don't, you know, you never deserved. You never were voted for. Nobody actually wanted you or anything. And you just, you know, just, yeah, it's just, yeah, what can you say? It's just pure, pure evil. This whole thing. So,
yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Anyway, what have you come up with for your double feature?
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret. What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
This was not easy because I feel like there were three lanes here. Germany, in which case I would look at things like Schindler's List or Lenin movie you mentioned a second ago that was a comedy that
mm-hmm. came up
when I was looking around.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could go with surveillance, where somebody's life is altered by surveilling somebody else. Or I could go with political intrigue and spy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was going to go political intrigue and spy stuff, it would be No Way Out with Kevin Costner,
wow.
Gene Hackman, and Will Patton.
Okay.
Which is a fantastic film, would make a great double feature here. This movie came out in 87. So practically in the era that Lives of Others is talking about, mm-hmm. was set in. But I decided I didn't want to do political intrigue and spy stuff. Mm-hmm. I wanted to stick with sort of the surveillance because this movie's called The Lives of Others. So the title of the movie is saying the point of this is him watching them and how it changed him.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation would be an easy one to choose here, but that has come up so often on this podcast, I'm afraid to choose it. Zero Dark Thirty, was one that I flirted with for mm-hmm. a good while. But what I'm going to end up with is not political or spy or Germany at all, and it's 1 hour photo.
That's interesting.
This is Robin Williams as a photo processing clerk at a Walmart-type store who becomes obsessed with one particular family to the point where he starts to have fantasies of being in their life, going into their house and having a beer with them.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a darker turn for sure than The Lives of Others. He's not changed for the better by surveilling these people, but The scene that sold me on this being the double feature is in The Lives of Others when he goes down and stands inside their apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out later he took a book while he was there. But he wants to, what's it like to be them? What's it like to be in this place? And that sensation, that feeling is all over 1 hour photo. It's worth it just for Robin Williams' performance alone. He, towards the end of his career, he was much more open to playing these creepy bastards and evil people.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought out a whole other layer of performance from him. You see, like in Insomnia.
I think they came out the same year, too. Like, the Insomnia and 1 hour photo, yeah.
So, anyway, 1 hour photo, if you haven't seen it, let me see if there is a place where you can watch it. Because that would be helpful. It looks like you will have to rent it. I'm great at giving suggestions.
Hey, you know what?
It's worth it.
It's not our fault that we come up with a movie and it just doesn't have a streaming option. I mean, it's the way it goes sometimes.
All right, so now it's time for next week's homework.
Mm-hmm.
And I am going with a movie that made just under $4 million at the box office.
Mm-hmm.
Steven Soderbergh's The Limey.
Aha.
You've seen this, right?
I've seen it a couple times, yeah.
Okay, thought so.
Mm-hmm.
This is Terrence Stamp. The framework of this story you've seen in other stories. It's a father whose daughter has been murdered, and he is working his way through the crime syndicate to the higher-ups to get his revenge. But this is not like any of those movies you've seen. This is right around the same time that Soderbergh was making
my favorite movie.
Oh, Out of Sight?
Out of Sight. So there's some very interesting camera work and music choices. Terrence Stamp is foul-mouthed as hell.
He's awesome.
Pissed off and angry. And there's one amazing scene in particular,
mm-hmm.
With a stationary camera that I really, really love. But this is a straight-up R-rated, action-y, angry dad beat-em-up movie before something like Taken made that a common genre. And you can watch this movie for free on Tubi with, I assume, commercials. It's on Vudu for free. It's on Plex for free. It's on Pluto TV for free, or you can rent it at any of the usual rental places.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, we will be discussing The Limey. It's a breezy 1 hour, 29 minute. I just think it's awesome, and I can't wait to, I haven't seen it in probably 10 years. So
yeah.
I can't wait to go back to it.
No, yeah, this is great. I saw it maybe last time I saw it was maybe 5 years ago, something like that. But yeah, it'll be good to get back on this one. I really enjoy this. This is definitely one of those kind of forgotten to time Steven Soderbergh movies, even though you run into people who are fans of it. You don't hear about it that often. So good stuff.
Tom over here says, I legit love the way both guys use the, I almost picked this in order to have multiple answers for the secret double
feature.
Well,
that's feature. Very true.
Yes, it is.
Welcome to how sins videos get created sometimes with those also sins. We do indeed do that.
All right.
Yeah.
You want to dive into a couple questions?
Yeah, do a few questions.
Question. I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
All right, start with this one. What are your biggest what ifs of cinema? For example, what if Will Smith had taken the role of Neo in The Matrix instead of making Wild Wild West?
The biggest one has got to be Tom Selleck being Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark, which you can't. Yeah. You can't really imagine. I mean, if you were a huge Magnum PI fan, maybe you can think of Tom Selleck in that role. I can't think of it. I can't imagine him in that role. But imagine what his career would have been like had he done Raiders of the Lost Ark. After he did Magnum PI, he had like a decent movie career. Like 3 Men and a Baby was his biggest movie, I think, and it wasn't really because of him.
No,
he did a lot of stuff like Quigley Down Under and Her Alibi and all those movies, like
Mr. Baseball.
Yeah, what was you know, what would Tom Selleck have like this? incredible, like Harrison Ford already had made it, right? Because he was in Star Wars and all that.
Yeah.
And he would have had probably a similar career to what he's already had without Indiana Jones. But geez, what a strange what if that is.
Yeah. Yeah. My biggest one is always Chris Farley and the Cable Guy. And that was before Ben Stiller became attached to that movie. And once Stiller got attached, he changed the tone to be darker. And that's where Jim Carrey became the perfect match.
But mm-hmm.
you imagine that movie with a different director, no dark tone, and Chris Farley as the annoying cable guy who wants to be your friend. It's a completely different movie.
Yeah.
And I think it might even have worked on its own level.
Yeah.
But the cable guy we got is the one that I'm glad we got.
Mm-hmm.
That was great.
Yeah.
I see some people saying some stuff over here in the.
Tom Cruise was Iron Man. Yeah. I remember hearing about that. That would have been in. I don't know if Tom Cruise would have been able to last. I don't know. He's done Mission Impossible multiple times and back then though, when he did Iron Man, would he have been down for the three movies and the Avengers and all that? Would he have done all that? I think we would have had a change in Iron Man like quick, probably.
Did you see yesterday the news on Deadline was that he and the director of those movies, Christopher Gord, have like three projects on track that aren't Mission Impossible movies?
Mm-hmm.
One is an unrelated action movie. One is a song and dance musical.
Okay.
And one is a Les Grossman
okay.
from Tropic Thunder
yeah.
thing. So, I don't know. They also said over here in the chat, Eric Stoltz in Back to the Future.
Oh, for sure. And if you've seen the footage of Eric Stoltz in Back to the Future,
yep,
that would have been maybe not a hit. Don't know.
I don't know. I think that was probably a decent change. That was not necessarily Stoltz's wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But look at what Eric Stoltz has gone on to do in his career for the most part, playing, Rye,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He plays Eric Stoltz.
He just never was. I don't know. I don't think he's ever been like a big box office, anchor a movie kind of guy, though. He's always been that supporting actor, I think.
All right, let's move on. What is your favorite fourth wall break?
Okay. There's a moment in Hot Shots Part 2 where they're having this big, huge Rambo battle or whatever, and in the middle of it, Miguel Ferrer comes out of the bushes and goes, "War, it's fantastic." And then just, that's it. And that's my favorite one.
I love that. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I like the ones in Jay and Silent Bob, Strike Back.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Smith has always done those fourth wall breaks.
Yeah.
But I saw on Twitter a couple days ago Eddie Murphy doing one from Trading Places, and I went and watched the scene where the old white guys are spelling out bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And
he goes, yeah.
It's great.
Sort of a trademark thing for him to do back in those John Landis movies he did. He did it in Coming to America as well.
Fleabag, JC says.
Yeah.
Great fourth wall book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's everything from Wayne's World. Yeah, Wayne's World has some good ones. I like the one too where he's like he's broken up with Cassandra and Garth has left him and all that. And he starts yelling and then the camera starts running away from him. Hey, come back, come back.
Oh man. All right, let's do another.
Mm-hmm.
Best performance in a bad movie. Worst performance in a good movie.
Okay.
I got the feeling we could take either one. I answered both.
Yeah, I did both. Tim Curry is a great performance in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Ooh. In fact, I don't know if that movie has the cult status it has without him at least giving you something that's worthwhile in that movie. I'm not a big Boondock Saints person.
Me neither.
It's got a 7.7 on the IMDb, so it's apparently got that Sin City vibe to it. I was going to say Willem Dafoe in that movie, but since everybody apparently likes the fucking Boondock Saints, I decided to go against that as a bad movie, even though I think it is. I think the sequel is even worse. Although the first one,
terrible.
The first one, to be fair, got cut up by Harvey Weinstein quite a bit, basically out of spite to the writer-director who made it. So who knows? Maybe there's a great movie there, or maybe I'm just missing something. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, we need to rip on Sin City every episode.
And we do, and do. Bad performance in a good movie, I don't blame her. I blame Kubrick, but Shelley Duvall in The Shining I don't think is very good at all. There's moments where I think she's fine, but especially when she has to act scared in this movie, I don't think it's good really at all. And it takes me out of it every time I see her like acting scared about anything. But considering what Kubrick put her through all the way through that production, I can't blame Shelley Duvall for not really doing the best there. So,
yeah.
That's a bad performance in a good movie to me.
I watched The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Which I did not enjoy as a film, but Jessica Chastain I thought was really good in that movie, and I think she was nominated for some awards, and I think that was deserving.
Yeah,
but I mean Andrew Garfield's good in that movie, but nobody in that movie is doing anything close to what she's doing. And then this is probably going to get more hell than the Sin City hate, but Harvey Keitel is probably the worst thing about Pulp Fiction, if you ask me. I don't like his line deliveries.
Okay, I respect your opinion, although I hate it. But isn't Quentin Tarantino in that very scene?
Okay. Well, okay, yes. Tarantino is worse than Keitel. I shouldn't phrase it the way it's saying he's the worst thing about
Okay,
him.
All right. All
but
right.
He's the worst professional actor about Pulp Fiction. Tarantino's just a bad actor.
Okay.
Keitel should know better.
Okay.
I feel like, and maybe part of it is because he probably didn't have to shoot for very many days for that movie, because he's only in that one, he's only in three scenes. The scene where he gets the call, the scene at the house, and then the scene at the wrecking yard. And so he probably only had to work a few days. So maybe he was just not.
Yeah, but I think he has some of the most,
feels like he
most
forgets what he's saying.
Some of the most memorable things are said in that scene. I don't know. This is a surprise. This knocked me on my ass when I saw you wrote this. I was like, what? Huh?
I don't like his performance in that movie.
No, let's not start sucking each other's dicks just yet.
I'm sorry.
And like, there's the point where like they talk about, they going on and on about that, how good that coffee is and everything, and then later when he gets the cup and drinks it, he has to turn around and he's like, I just think it's great. I don't know, Winston Wolfe, great.
No, I mean, I'm the guy who tweeted like a year ago, every time I watch Pulp Fiction, I like it less. So maybe that's
I can
just
understand
where my
not liking
at.
The movie as much as you did back in the day. I don't know about the Keitel thing, but hey, to each his own, right? You can be wrong and be fine with it. It's not a big deal.
The chat agrees with you.
No, I mean, most people are going to agree with me. I'm not worried about, you know, if it's just it's interesting to me. I did not expect this.
Well, I still like the movie. I like Keitel's career. I like Keitel. It's just in this particular movie, it doesn't feel like he's acting. It feels like he's trying to remember his lines. Sorry. Maybe we should end. Let's end on a better note.
Okay.
Because that's no good. Who's your favorite repeat creative combo? You can do composer, director, actor, director, writer, director, etc. People that work together a lot.
It's kind of hard to ignore the work that Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro did together for so long. Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Goodfellas, Casino. These movies and De Niro are unbelievable, and of course the King of Comedy as well. De Niro was, I don't know if it was, I don't know if it was because he felt pushed by Scorsese or what, did some of his most probably dangerous to his own personal life work that he's ever done with Scorsese, especially like Raging Bull, where he's like, you know, he's like gains all those pounds and he's like, you know, and he just gets into these places where, you know, it's no wonder that the De Niro we saw later on started just to kind of like, you know, all right, I'm just here to have fun now. I don't want to do any of these dark down in the dirt roles anymore. You can see how it might affect somebody to do that over and over again. But,
oh yeah.
But those movies, you know, that's their best work. I mean, Scorsese has obviously done a lot of great things with DiCaprio later on. I don't know if DiCaprio has done anything to the level of what De Niro did back in those days, though. So, anyway.
Yeah. No, I like that answer.
Mm-hmm.
I like seeing Michael Caine show up in Christopher Nolan movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even in, like, Inception or Tenet, where he's really only in, like, one or two scenes.
Yep.
I just have the feeling they have, like, I like to pretend they have, like, a grandfather, grandson, father-son, protege, mentor kind of relationship. He's in all three of the Batman movies.
Mm-hmm.
He's in The Prestige. He's in Inception. He's in Tenet. that's one of my answers. My other answer is J.J. Abrams and Michael Giacchino. This goes back to even Alias and Lost, but the Star Trek movies. I just like Michael Giacchino.
Yeah.
He'd probably work with J.J. more than anybody. But
mm-hmm.
Always looking for an answer to...
In the chat, we have Johnny Depp and Tim Burton. I think Johnny Depp definitely did his best work for the most part with Tim Burton, or at least the most interesting and varied work. He did a lot of good stuff in the 90s. Donnie Brasco, which was not Tim Burton, but like most of the Tim Burton, like Ed Wood is probably one of his best performances ever. And also Danny Elfman, obviously Danny Elfman's music along with Tim Burton. George Lucas and John Williams and Spielberg and John Williams. Yeah, John Williams is, mm-hmm. you know. Money back in those days. Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. That's a good one. Especially with the Cornetto trilogy and all of that. So, yeah, really good stuff there. Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell. Mm-hmm. Definitely good. All right. Well, that's a show, I think. I think we did some sort of show there. Thank you once again, Patreon people out there watching us. We appreciate you coming out and commenting as we discuss Jeremy's bad takes on Harvey Keitel. next week is going to be the limey Steven Soderbergh's 1999 film. Can't wait to talk about that. Hope you guys like The Lives of Others. But that'll do it for this week. We'll see you guys.
Thanks, everybody.
See ya.
Bye.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Sup, dude.
What's going on?
Sup at the whack PlayStation. Sup.
Mm-hmm.
That's from Friends. Are you watching Better Call Saul?
No. I'm sort of just waiting until the episodes are done, and then I can run through it instead of going week to week.
Only one more week, then.
Because I did that with the last half season that came out. Waited until it was done. You know, obviously I have to avoid spoilers. So anytime you have something like Kim Wexler or something like that trending on Twitter, you just avoid it.
Yes.
But yeah. I will eventually see it.
Still not sure that I don't want to be this guy. I saw a review today of the show, and this won't have spoilers, but the reviewer said, I think this show is better than Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm.
I realize that might be controversial, and I'm like, are you kidding? That's all anybody who watches this show ever says, is that it's better than Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
and I'm not trying to...
I love Better Call...
I'm trying to compare them.
I love Better Call Saul, but it's not Breaking Bad.
No, and I don't think the show benefits as much as people think from having all the Breaking Bad characters show up here and there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it only proves that Better Call Saul is dependent on Breaking Bad.
No kidding.
It couldn't exist. If they released this show and Breaking Bad had never existed,
yeah,
there's a lot, at least, of cameos that you'd be like, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
Why did they... What? They got Bryan Cranston for...
Yeah.
One scene? I don't need to see what's in Darth Vader's balls.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I'm going to make that a small recommend.
Mm-hmm.
Phone is ringing. This will be a great outtake. Scam likely. He calls me every day.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, the whole Likely family is terrible.
Does your phone tell you when an incoming call is likely to be a scam?
Yeah. It says, well, what does it say? It doesn't say scam likely. It just says, it might say, oh, yeah, it just says spam risk.
Ah, okay.
It doesn't say scam.
It's probably the same thing being identified by both Google and iPhone. They're just calling it a different... They just name their alert something different.
I mean, it doesn't matter for me anyway, because if I don't recognize the number, I don't answer it, so...
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there was a period of time there where I was getting plagued with these, you know, like, Citibank says your account is upheld or being suspended or something like that. And I'm like, I know that this probably works. I mean, this is the point, right? It works one out of like 100,000 people. It works. And that's all they need.
Yeah. Yeah. My boss at the web design company, and the company was split in two parts. They did web design, and then they also did like business computer server setups and stuff like that, mm-hmm. maintenance. And my boss had this little speech. I can't do it any justice, but he would break down the math about why people still send spam emails.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you get 0.000001% of the people respond, then if you are, you know, extrapolate that over this, and then he would end up at like this huge dollar amount that would always blow your mind.
Yeah, well, and think about it, you're not spending any money to do that either,
right?
You know,
it's all automated,
so yeah, it's just there's no overhead in that scam.
There's a new scam I was reading about where they text you and it seems like just a wrong number. And then when you say wrong number back, they keep trying to engage you in, oh, well then who did I text? Is this Steve
that
or
happened,
have you? And if you
that happened
go long enough, they try and scam you.
That happened with a phone that I had. This was before texting. Phone that I had at my parents' house that was my own line and everything like that. And somebody called. Now I was naive. I didn't have any idea what was going on. So they called and they said, this is a job opportunity for somebody or whatever. And I called them back saying, you got the wrong number. And then they called me back saying, well, how about you then or whatever. And so I was like, what the fuck is all this? But eventually, I didn't do anything and do anything stupid, like sign up with anything, but I was like, what is this thing? And then finally my older brother just called them up and said, stop calling. and that was it. So
nice.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Maybe he went to the warehouse and yelled at Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Shut the fuck up.
Man, I hope that Philip Seymour Hoffman goes down as one of the best actors ever.
I think he's got a bad performance. Pretty much people think of him that way.
I agree, but he's still not like a household name.
Mm-hmm.
Like my mom probably doesn't know his name.
Yeah.
But if you're a film buff, then yeah, I think he's already up there. But yeah, what was on the other day that he was in? Oh, Mission Impossible 3.
Mm-hmm.
Which as a whole, I can take or leave. It's very Alias-ish,
mm-hmm.
but his performance is incredible.
It really
it's like
is.
It's like he thought he was in an Oscar-nominated movie or something.
You threw me off a plane.
You threw me out of a plane. Do you have a girlfriend, wife? I don't know, whoever it is, I'm going to find her.
I'm going to hurt her. Yeah.
So menacing without even trying to be menacing.
That's why I loved so much that was him and Tom Cruise, because I got to do that outtake with Tom Cruise being the asshole in Magnolia to him. where he's like, I will drop kick that fucking dog if he comes anywhere near me. And then my favorite's owning Mahoney, just because there's something about that performance that just kills me. Have you ever seen Owning Mahoney?
There's one that I don't think so.
Speaking of Philip Seymour Hoffman performances that you should see, it would be that. He plays a Canadian banker guy who flies out to Atlantic City and he rolls craps on the bank's money. The bank's he's trying to cover up for gambling debts. And he's such a well regarded person at that bank that he can pretty much, people will just believe whatever he says. So like there's a moment where someone's like, I can't find this file for this guy. And it's basically money missing. And he goes, oh, don't worry about it. That guy sold bonds today. He came in or whatever. And it's like, oh, okay. And everybody's just like, ah, whatever. So he takes that money and he goes down to Atlantic City and he's throwing craps. And of course he gets on huge heaters where he's like, driving up his, you know, driving up the amount that he's collecting, but he also loses a lot. And John Hurt plays the casino manager guy who doesn't want to know anything about Mahoney. He just wants him here because he unloads all that money into his casino and everything. Philip Seymour Hoffman is dating Minnie Driver, and Minnie Driver wants to get married, and he's trying to work. I think he's trying to work his way to do that. He keeps trying to get out of debt is his problem. So like there's that relationship going on. He does a really good, I think really good Canadian accent. It's not like over the top, but you can tell it's there, you know, like, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.